Welcome to Unveiled Faces, a Redeemer Presbyterian Church podcast. Please enjoy our feature presentation.
When I was a young child, there was a television program called Hee Haw. And it was co-hosted by Buck Owens and Roy Clark. And one of the skits that was performed on the show was a comical dialogue between Roy Clark and his barber, Archie. And the skit is called Good News, Bad News. Archie says, the barber, he says, Archie said, yes, my terrible misfortune. And Roy says, oh? And Archie said, and Roy says, oh, that's bad. And Archie says, no, that's good. Roy says, how come? Well, when he died, he left me $50,000. Oh, that's good. No, that's bad. How come? Well, when the IRS got through with it, all I had left was $25,000. Oh, that's bad. No, that's good. How come? Well, I bought me an airplane and learned to fly. Oh, that's good. No, that's bad. How come? Well, I was flying upside down the other day and fell out of the thing. Oh, that's bad. Archie says, no, that's good. How come? Well, I looked down under me, and there was a big old haystack. Well, that's good. No, that's bad. How come? Well, I got a little closer, and I saw a pitchfork aimed right at me. Oh, that's bad. No, that's good. How come? I missed the pitchfork. Well, that's good. No, that's bad. How come? I missed the haystack, too. Well, what this little skit demonstrates is that it is difficult for us to know whether a particular situation is going to turn out good or bad. There are situations that look bad in the moment, but as they continue to develop and as we continue to see the bigger picture, then we see that something good is actually going to come out of what appeared to be bad. Our sermon text this morning contains a promise. It's a promise made exclusively to Christians, to those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. And the promise is that everything that we experience in this life will work out to our good. Everything will work together for our good. And this seems like something that's too good to be true, but let me remind you that the Almighty Creator of heaven and earth is the one who's making this promise. If it were anybody else anybody other than the sovereign God of the Scriptures making this promise, then we would definitely have reason to be skeptical. But this is a promise directly from our triune God. And notice how the promise begins in verse 28. It begins with the declaration, and we know. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God. It does not say that we feel like all things work together for good. It says that we know. And this is an important distinction for us to keep in mind because our feelings are not always consistent with the way things really are. Our feelings are not always consistent with the way things really are. And this is especially true in times of hardship and suffering. When difficult situations develop in my life, I don't always feel like those situations are actually working out together for my good. In fact, my feelings tell me quite the opposite. My feelings tell me that deep grief and sorrow are going to leave lifelong emotional scars upon me. My feelings tell me that pain and suffering can only lead to distress and despair. My feelings tell me that conflicts in my relationships are going to prevent me from experiencing true peace and joy. My feelings tell me that other people's mistreatment of me and disloyalty to me are going to leave me vulnerable, betrayed, and victimized. My feelings tell me that whenever adversity and unhealthy situations develop in my life, this is an indication that my life is heading in the wrong direction, that the trajectory of my life is away from what is good, not moving closer to good, but moving farther away from what is good. That's what my feelings tell me. Do your feelings ever tell you similar things? When trouble comes upon you, do you sometimes feel like things are always going from bad to worse? This is because our emotions are terrible guides. Notice I didn't say emotions are terrible. I said that they make terrible guides. This is because emotions are always experienced passively. We don't necessarily choose the emotions that we're going to experience. They more or less just happen within us and force themselves upon us. Emotions are, however, an essential part of human life. God created us with the capacity to experience emotions, and that is good. It's part of God's good design for us. And this is confirmed for us not only in the garden, but it's confirmed for us in the person of Jesus Christ. As the perfect human in whom there was no sin or any form of defect, Jesus experienced emotions. He cried, he sorrowed, he grieved. He also loved and rejoiced and worshiped. And this demonstrates that emotions have a purpose in our lives. Even though our emotions have been compromised by sin, they still serve a needed function within our lives. They stir our hearts. They stir our hearts to love God and to love others. Emotions stir our hearts to worship the Lord. They stir our hearts to rejoice in the truth. They stir our hearts to empathize with one another. They stir our hearts to draw near to the Lord in our times of sorrow and distress. They stir our hearts to cry out to God when we've been betrayed and abandoned by family and friends. Our emotions produce passion. They produce an internal fervor that motivates us to do and to say whatever it is we do and say with passion. But emotions do not produce good guidance. A good guidance comes from knowledge of the truth and the wisdom to walk in it. And this is why the promise in our sermon text is worded the way it is. As Christians, we may not always feel like things are working together for our good, but because God's revelation to us is true, we know that they are. We can know that they are. And we know that all things work together for the good of those who love God, it says in verse 28. So if this promise is going to bring us into a position of safety and security in Christ Jesus, we must be guided by what we know God has said about my life, not what my feelings are telling me about my life. You'll also note that in verse 28, it does not say that we understand how all things work together for our good. Oftentimes, God chooses not to explain the details of how and why these things happen to his people. Maybe it's because God's plans are too complex for us. Maybe our puny brains cannot even begin to plumb the depths of God's majestic plan, so he just chooses not to tell us on that basis. Or maybe it's because we could not handle the truth if it was given to us. Maybe our mortal brains and bodies would be overcome by the weight and gravity of it all if God were to disclose to us his mighty plans. Or maybe it's just because God desires that we live by faith and not by sight. Maybe he withholds certain information from us because he wants us to trust in him with all of our hearts and lean not upon our own understanding. Whatever God's reason is for not sharing all the details of his plan, sometimes he just declares the way it is and leaves it at that. And God can do that. Right? He has the right to do that. He doesn't need to explain to you and me the details of his plan. Job learned this lesson in a very powerful way. If you read the book of Job, then you'll remember that Job began to question God, asking him to reveal things that God had chosen not to reveal, or things that God had chosen to conceal from Job. And then God at a particular point in the book of Job, he turns the tables on Job. Appearing to him in a whirlwind, God began asking Job questions. And the first question was, who is this that darkens counsel with words without knowledge? Can you imagine what it would be like to have the Almighty Creator of heaven and earth appear before you in a fierce, tempestuous whirlwind? And the first thing he says to you is, who are you to question my counsel when you don't even know what you're asking about? And then God continues speaking to Job. He says, now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. And then over the next four chapters, God asks 77 questions, all of them designed to impress upon Job the utter foolishness of thinking that a finite man can understand the details of how and why our infinite Creator governs his creation the way he does. For example, God asked Job, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? And when God finished asking all 77 questions, do you remember how Job responded? His response was, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now, Job's response was the right response. And what I mean by this is that it was the righteous response. It's the response every one of us should have if we ever begin to think that God needs to give us more explanation than he has already given to us. If we think that God needs to explain himself, reveal himself more than he has chosen to do, if we're going to trust him and we're truly going to do the things that he called us to do, and that we're truly going to believe that all things are working together for our good. Brothers and sisters, if you're not presently experiencing some form of trial in which you want to ask those questions, then the time is probably very short before you will. And the desire for you to know those questions will rise. And there's no problem seeking the Lord's will in matters, but we cannot demand that he reveal things to us that he has chosen to conceal. We cannot demand it. And something is in your life is going to happen that's the exact opposite of what you had intended. Your career is going to make an unexpected turn. Your spouse is going to disappoint you. The peace in your family is going to be broken. One of your cherished relationships is going to be strained. Those in authority will stifle you, oppress you. Your health is going to fail. Your savings are going to be depleted. Your car is going to die. Or some other difficult thing is going to steer your life in the direction that you did not choose, and you're going to say to yourself, I don't understand how God is making these particular things work together for my good. I don't understand it. And it's perfectly fine for you to acknowledge that you don't understand how God is doing what he says he does. In fact, it's healthy to acknowledge that you don't understand. But don't let your lack of understanding prevent you from knowing and believing that his promise is true. Don't let your lack of understanding prevent you from knowing and believing that his promise is true. You don't need to be able to explain how God is working all things together for your good. Just know that he is. Say with Job, these things are too wonderful for me. I don't understand them, but I know that God can do everything and that no purpose of his can be withheld from him. So if God tells me that he will make my trials and tribulations my difficulties and disappointments, my struggles and strivings, my mistakes and misfortunes, my failures and fears all work together for my good, then I'm going to believe him. Then I am going to believe him. I'm not going to question him. I am going to put my hand over my mouth, and I'm going to trust that the Lord God Almighty does what he says he does. Brothers and sisters, we are called to be people who live by faith, which means our lives must be governed by something deeper and more substantial than our emotions and our lack of understanding. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. We won't often see how God is presently working all things together for our good. But by faith, we can know with certainty that he is. And we know, it says at the beginning of verse 28, and we know. If you're not able to say with confidence that you know God is working all things for your good, then you are deprived of one of the greatest comforts God has given to believers. Realize, God created us. He knows our frame, it says in Psalm 103, verse 14. He remembers that we are but dust. He knows that we are fragile and delicate as a flower in the field. And if a scorching wind blows over that flower, what happens to it? It withers away. It dies. Because God knows our frame, he knows how much scorching wind we are able to sustain. And so he does not give us more than we can endure. And in his mercy to us, he gives us his promise of comfort to comfort us as those scorching winds of hardship and suffering are blowing upon us. And our sermon text today is one of those promises. He gave us this particular promise, this promise that he's working all things together for the good of those who love him. But if you're not going to believe in this promise, if you're not going to receive it by faith and know it, then you're depriving yourself of the soul-sustaining mercy that God intended for this promise to provide to you. You've put yourself on a path of distress, discouragement, and disillusionment. And that path will eventually lead to doubt, defeat, and distance between you and God. That's not a path you want to walk. That's not the path of faith. But it doesn't need to be that way. The scorching winds of hardship will blow upon you, but the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him. Knowing the truth of his promise is his merciful provision so that we can still grow and thrive and prosper even in the midst of the hardships of life. Believing that he is working all things together for your good, even though you don't understand how he's doing it, is what it means to walk by faith. That, brothers and sisters, is what it means to walk by faith. It's sinful pride that says, if I can't understand it, then I won't believe it. It's a lack of faith that says, there's no way God can use this terrible situation in my life for my good. Humble yourselves, brothers and sisters. Trust that the Lord does exactly what he says. And if you've doubted his promise, then repent of your unbelief. Call out to him in the name of Jesus Christ, asking for the faith to live in accordance with this life-sustaining promise. And he will answer that petition. He will answer that petition. You'll begin to experience a peace that surpasses all understanding. God will give you the firm conviction that he definitely is working all things together for your good, and you will rejoice in this knowledge. It will be a comfort to you. It will be one of the chief ways that you hide yourself in the sovereignty of your triune God. Notice the verb works in verse 28. The promise is that God works all things together for our good. And this verb is written in the present tense and the active voice, which means that God is always and continually at work, causing all things that happen in your life to come together for your good. And this grammatical construction assures us that there's never a time when God is not working to cause all things to be for your good. God never ceases from his work, in other words. Nothing's happening in your life that you would be able to look at and say, well, I think by and large, God typically works things out for my good, but this is an anomaly. This particular thing falls outside the purview of God's working. No, God never ceases from his work. He is always performing it. He's using everything that happens in your life for your good. And this is not to say that everything that's happening in your life is good. There are things that are happening in your life that I'm sure are definitely not good. Sin is not good. Evil is not good. The wickedness of your fellow man is not good. The deception of the evil one is not good. So we don't read our sermon text and conclude that God will prevent evil from happening to us. We don't read our sermon text and conclude that if we love God and are called according to his purpose, then only good things will happen to us. Rather, we read our sermon text and come away with the sure confidence that God makes all the righteous things that happen in our lives, as well as all the evil things that happen in our lives, to work together for our good. In other words, all things means all things. In application then, we acknowledge that the positive things that happen in our life work for our good, right? The positive things that happen in our life work for our good. We don't have a difficult time grasping this. You make good grades in school. That works to your good. You enjoy mutually edifying times of fellowship with your friends. We can see how that works for our good. You get married. You have a baby. You get promoted at work. The police officer lets you go with only a warning. Your physical health is good. Your parents raised you in a loving home where you learned about the gospel of Jesus Christ. Your stock portfolio is earning money. The chance card says, advance to go, collect $200. Our sermon text is telling us that God makes all of these positive things work for our good. And like I said, we don't really have much difficulty embracing this because it's easy to see how these things benefit us. But it's more of a challenge to see how God uses the difficult things that happen in our lives, that he makes those work for our good. You fail a class at school and you need to retake it. The people you thought were your friends turn out not to be your friends. Your spouse disappoints you. He or she doesn't live up to your expectations. Your baby is born with Down syndrome. You lose your job. The police officer does give you a speeding ticket. You're diagnosed with cancer. Your parents abused you. Your stock portfolio has crashed. And the chance card says, advance to Boardwalk, which somebody else owns and has a hotel on it. Our sermon text is telling us that God uses even these difficult situations in our lives for our good. God is so wise and he's so powerful and his sovereignty is so comprehensive over all the affairs of this world that he even uses the evil things in this world for our good, for the good of those who love him, for the good of those who are called according to his purpose. In no way does this justify evil. In no way does this sanction sin. In no way does it make something that was evil good. The end never justifies the means. Just because God made something good come out of evil doesn't mean that evil is no longer evil. The warning of Isaiah 5:20 is still in effect. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. We must not mix those two. We must not become ambiguous. We must not equivocate on those. So the promise in Romans 8:28 does nothing to redefine what is good and what is evil. Those definitions remain just as they always have. But what the promise does do is assure us that God will cause whatever happens to us, whether it's good or evil, to work for our good. And we could join with Joseph in Egypt, in saying that the evil that others intended against us, God used for our good. And so the point is clear. If you love God and you're called according to his purpose, then there's nothing that happens to you, nothing that has happened in your past that God is not using for your good. There's nothing that's happening to you right now in the present that God is not using for your good. And there's nothing that's going to happen to you in the future that God will not use for your good. He is always working, and all things, past, present, and future, are working together. He is working together for your good. But we need to understand what God means by good. Because if we're using a different definition than God is using, we're very likely to be misinterpreting this promise. And this will likely cause us to be disappointed with God's providence in our life. We're going to be looking around and we're going to be wondering, when am I going to see the good that God promised me? To discern how God is using the word good in our sermon text, we need to pay attention to the context. Very basic rule of biblical interpretation. The context here is telling us that God has a purpose for us. We have been called according to his purpose, it says at the end of verse 8. And what is God's purpose for you? Well, the answer is in verse 29. He predestined us to be conformed to the image of his son. He predestined us to be conformed to the image of his son. And the purpose of God, therefore, is to conform us, those who love him, into the image of our Savior Jesus Christ. We understand this to be describing our spiritual transformation from sinners to saints, from sinners who used to live as enemies in rebellion to God to saints who are now progressively living in closer and closer communion with God. In other words, God's purpose is to accomplish your sanctification. So when God says that he works all things together for our good, the good that he's referring to is our sanctification. God makes all things work together for our sanctification. Now, does it comfort you to know that this is what God is doing in your life? Does it help you to trust him with all the circumstances of your life, knowing that the things which are happening are actually being used for your good, for your sanctification? What's your biggest grievance in life right now? What's the one thing that you most wish you had the power to change? What's the one thing you wish you could snap your fingers and make go away? What our sermon text is telling you is that God is presently using that thing, that very thing, for your sanctification, and that is good. God says this is for your good. If that thing was not part of your life, if it had never been part of your life, you wouldn't be the same person that you are right now. You wouldn't be as sanctified as you are right now. You wouldn't be as conformed to the image of Christ as you are right now. Sometimes when I'm waiting at a traffic light, waiting to make a left turn, and I notice that the light skips me. Have you ever had that happen to you? Everybody else gets to go, but not me. So I wait for the traffic lights to go through their complete rotation, and then finally I get to make my left turn. Well, my initial response to that situation is frustration. As soon as I notice that the light skipped me, I often respond in the flesh by murmuring about how deficient the lights are. If people were in the car with me, they hear about it. And my first thought is usually something like, why can't the city install vehicle detectors that actually work? Now, as I sit there waiting for the lights, I have time to contemplate. And then God begins to use those 2 or 3 minutes for my sanctification. And I'm reminded that I don't know what God knows. I have no idea what would have happened to me if the light actually did turn green and I was able to make that left turn. Would I have been involved in a car accident a couple miles down the road? Maybe God was sparing me from an accident by making me wait at the light. Or maybe the delay at the stoplight made it so that I arrived at my destination at exactly the same time as somebody the Lord wanted me to talk with. Did the Lord make it so that I could share the gospel with somebody where I would not have had that opportunity had the light turned green immediately? Or maybe the fact that my car happened to be at a certain place at a certain time because of the delay at the light, that this prevented a pedestrian from being struck by a different car. Right? Who knows? Who can say in these regards? It's like the butterfly effect, right? We can't possibly know how some seemingly minor, insignificant little change is going to affect ourselves and other people and society and even the whole world. What we need to remember is that nothing happens by mistake or consequence or coincidence. If the Lord has put you in a difficult circumstance, there's a reason for that. There is a reason that he has for that. He is conforming you into the person he has purposed for you to be. And if you can only see what he truly is accomplishing in your life through those circumstances, you wouldn't want to snap your fingers and make the situation go away. You would not want that. You'd be thinking, I can see how much good the Lord is accomplishing in my life through this. I can see how this is conforming me into the image of Jesus Christ. And I would not give that up for anything, because this work that he's performing in me will last for all eternity. As a Christian, you should be able to reflect back upon your years as a Christian, your Christian life, and you should be able to recognize, if you've been a Christian for a while, you should be able to recognize how God has used pleasant times as well as the not so pleasant times to bring your character more and more into conformity with the righteousness of Jesus Christ. I say this because if you're the person that's described in verse 28 of our sermon text, right? If you're the person who loves God and has been called according to his purpose, then God has been actively conforming you into the image of his son ever since the day you became a Christian. So you should be able to look back upon the years of your Christian walk and see noticeable transformations of holiness in your life. For some of you, you'll notice that you don't use filthy language the way you used to. For others, you'll notice that you don't complain and grumble the way you used to. Or that you don't harbor resentment the way that you used to. Or that you don't lust the way that you used to. Or you don't covet the way you used to. You don't hate the way you used to. You don't lie the way you used to. You don't get angry the way you used to. You don't get drunk the way you used to. You don't gossip the way you used to. You don't rebel against authority the way you used to. You don't steal. You're not lazy like you used to be. You're not selfish like you used to be. You're not proud the way you used to be. You're not envious the way you used to be. And the list goes on and on. This is what the Bible refers to as good fruit that the Lord produces in your life. If you love the Lord and are called according to his purpose, then he is conforming you into the image of his son, which is producing good fruit in your life. Every Christian's life bears good fruit. Fruit unto holiness, it says in Romans 6:20. And Jesus said that some Christians bear fruit 30-fold, some 60-fold, and some 100-fold. And these different levels of production describe the different stages of sanctification, or this different stages of progress that has been accomplished in each of our sanctification. Some of us are further along that path to conformity into the image of the Son of Jesus, into the image of the Son, than others are. Some of us are further along down that path than others. But every Christian will bear good fruit. In John 15, verses 1 and 2, Jesus said, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. The branches that do not bear any fruit are those who falsely profess Christ. They're the ones that falsely profess Christ. They're the pretenders in the church. Jesus said that that they will be cut off from the vine. They will be thrown into the fires of hell. But notice what he says he does with those branches that do bear good fruit. He says that he prunes them so that they bear more fruit. Now, brothers and sisters, God will often use the difficult and painful situations and circumstances in your life to prune you. That's the pruning process. Those difficulties are the pruning so that you will bear more fruit. At the time that this is happening, this pruning, it may not appear all that much different than the branches that are actually being cut off, right? The ones that are being cut off and thrown into fire, they're being cut just as you're being cut. But in both cases, God is making painful cuts somewhere along the branch. But there's a huge difference between the branch that's cut off from the vine and the branch that is pruned back so that it can bear more fruit. The branch that's cut off is no longer connected to the vine. It's going to wither and die, whereas the branch that's only been pruned remains connected to the vine, which is the life source providing nourishment needed in order that it can continue to bear fruit, in fact, more fruit. And the great comfort that this gives to us is that every person who loves the Lord and who has been called according to his purpose is never cut off of the vine. Never, ever cut off of the vine. But we are certainly pruned. Pruned so that we can bear more fruit. Pruned so that we can be brought into closer conformity to the image of Jesus Christ. God's pruning causes a Christian who has been bearing 30-fold to increase to 60-fold. And the Christian who has been bearing 60-fold to increase to 100-fold. So if you've been a Christian for any period of time, you should be able to look back upon your Christian walk and see the increase of fruit in your life because of God's pruning. That increase is a result of God working all things together for your good, which includes the painful things in your life, as well as the good things, the more pleasant things. Now, what should be our response to this great promise as we read in our sermon text? Well, there's at least three things that warrant our response. First, we need to receive this promise by faith and let it bring comfort to us, especially in those times of pruning, especially during those difficult circumstances. Even if we don't understand how God will use something to our good, even if it looks like there's nothing good that could possibly come out of this situation, we need to know by faith that his power is at work in every situation, always at work, never ceasing, to bring about your good. So that's the first response. The second response, we need to acknowledge that we don't need we need to acknowledge that we need to receive God's definition of good. Right? We don't get to define what is good. God defines this. He defines it as our conformity to the image of Christ. We would be tempted to define good as prosperity, as peace, as lack of conflict in our lives, but that's not God's definition. His definition is our sanctification. And third, we need to receive God's providence in our lives as opportunities to draw near to him and to walk in closer fellowship with him. This means we lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily ensnares us, and we run with endurance a race that's set before us, all the while looking to who? Looking unto Jesus, because he is the author and finisher of our faith. And this is the purpose to which you have been called. This is what God says is good, and he is accomplishing it in your life. So praise be to the Lord for his grace, his mercy, and his sovereign exercise of his will over every aspect of your life, which he works for your good.
This has been a presentation of Redeemer Presbyterian Church. For more resources and information, please stop by our website at visitredeemer.org. All material here within, unless otherwise noted, copyright Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Elk Grove, California. Music furnished by Nathan Clark George, available at nathanclarkgeorge.com.